Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Maher, and I'll be your host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 under the generous bequests of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. Hinckley strives to teach students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. Hinckley offers internships to students of all majors here locally, in D.C., and in 35 nations around the globe. Hinckley also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in D.C., and over $400,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Made in America, Bringing Decision-Making Home. Our guest is Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell, Alaska's Lieutenant Governor, as well as John Ratzenberger, a renowned actor. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Well, thank you. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being here, and it's wonderful to meet you. I had to say, I had him confused as a faculty member. He's a sharp dresser and a sharp student. My name is Meade Treadwell, and I'm the Lieutenant Governor of Alaska. And for those of you who don't know what a Lieutenant Governor does, the joke is my job is to stay healthy in case the governor doesn't. But my job is also to help our governor. In our quest to help our constituents participate in the world economy. The subject of today's talk is Made in America and Bringing Decision-Making Home. And what I thought I would talk about just for a moment is what we're doing in the state of Alaska to play a role in the global economy and what we're trying to do to bring decision-making home. And as part of one of those three things that we're doing in Alaska to bring decision-making home, I'm very glad that my friend John Ratzenberger, who is an actor, was known to you as Cliff on Cheers. You've heard him, his voice on virtually every Pixar film. Around our house, he's known as Hammy the Pig. But John has also been the host of a television series called Made in America. And he'll be introduced further in a moment. But it's been fun to travel with John a number of ways because we have a common theme, which is our country can be strong. Our country can be much stronger if we dedicate ourselves to production. Now, let me just start about Alaska for a second. Alaska was known as Seward's Folly when 365 million acres was purchased from the Russians by the United States by William Henry Seward, our Secretary of State, in 1867. That's 147 years ago. And as the Lieutenant Governor of Alaska, I will tell you that one of our challenges yet today is to convince people we're worth it. Other nicknames for Alaska besides Seward's Folly were Wall Russia, Seward's Icebox. And the fact is that we have done some pretty amazing things. For those of you listening at home, I'd urge you to take out a map of Alaska or a polar projection. We have one on a screen up in front of us. And this may be the first time that you've ever looked down from the top of the world to look at Alaska in its neighborhood. Because it is by the fact that the United States owns Alaska that we're not just a Pacific nation, not just an Atlantic nation, we're also an Arctic nation. And as you can see, we live in a neighborhood at the top of the world where we have neighbors in Russia, Canada, Denmark, which owns Greenland, Iceland, Norway, Sweden, Finland. And the fact is that these eight nations have come together recently since the end of the Cold War to establish an Arctic Council. Now, many people ask me, can I see Russia from my house? 147 years ago, of course you could, because we were Russia. The fact is, I've seen Alaska from Russia many times. I've flown in Russian helicopters right by the Diomedes, two tiny little islands right in the middle of the Bering Strait, helped open the border between the United States and Russia in 1988, helped establish ecotourism in the Bering Sea, among a number of other ventures I've done in my lifetime. That was one of the more exciting things. I never thought I would find myself in a Russian helicopter high above Wrangel Island, which is right here on the Russian coast, where a fifth of the world's polar bear are born, And the pilot puts the helicopter in autopilot and comes back to sit on the gas tank to smoke a cigarette. Luckily, the gas tank didn't explode, and I'm here today. But the fact is that we live in a very unique part of the world, and there are three things that really drive our economy. The first, I like to say, are the resources beneath our feet. And whether it's beneath our feet on the land or beneath our feet beneath the sea, we are a significant natural resource extractor. We have a Prudhoe Bay on the north coast of Alaska. We've got the largest oil field in North America. It was discovered in 1968 by Atlantic Richfield Company and has been developed by Atlantic Richfield, now ConocoPhillips, British Petroleum, and Exxon since that time. We produced at one point 25% of America's oil. The Great Alaska Pipeline, which was finished the year I was a junior in college, was producing over 2 million barrels a day. Today, that pipeline is only bringing less than 600,000 barrels a day. It's a significant drop, and the reason why it's a significant drop is because Washington, D.C. has decided that we shouldn't have access to lands offshore, or that should be delayed for a long time. We shouldn't have access to lands to the east of the pipeline and to the west of the pipeline, and we've been working very hard to make sure that we're competitive, because in this Arctic neighborhood, there are great oil prospects in Russia, great oil prospects in Norway, great oil prospects in Iceland, great oil prospects in Greenland, great oil prospects in Canada, and if America doesn't understand that we have to compete, our energy won't be made in America, it'll be made someplace else. A second place where we compete with resources beneath our feet is in mining. And we have very sad news today, because today the Environmental Protection Agency announced that they might take steps to veto a mine found on land owned by the state of Alaska before they ever have a chance to file a first permit. That's known as the Pebble Mine. I will tell you, because I was once Deputy Commissioner of Environment in my state, that mine may or may not make it through the process of objective criteria of whether or not you can build a mine, but the EPA is serving with unobjective criteria.
I'm just going to see your package because I can see this one.
The EPA serving with unobjective criteria has said that they may now take steps to veto that mine before they ever get started. And here, this is land that we received as part of our statehood compact. We wanted to bring decision-making home by becoming a state. We put this land up for exploration, and dang, somebody found what may be $500 billion worth of minerals on it in about a 7-square-mile area, and the federal government is saying, we're not sure we're going to let you even go in there to build it. Another set of resources beneath our feet is that the coastline around Alaska, which is the size of all the rest of the coastline in the United States put together, produces about $3 billion worth of fisheries every year. And you'll find that in your freezer. Besides what's beneath our feet, another thing we have is strategic location. FedEx and UPS have their largest hubs in Alaska. Missile Defense is based in Alaska to cover the entire country. And we also have a situation where we are constantly in the area of Arctic shipping on the seaways of the world. For many, many years, almost all shipping across the North Pacific, leaving ports in California, leaving ports in the state of Washington, leaving ports in Vancouver, all would go by the Great Circle route through the Aleutians. It's about 5,000 ships a year. Now we have a very interesting situation where, take a look at that Arctic Ocean. The ice, the multi-year ice in the Arctic Ocean has gone out of the Arctic Ocean beginning about 2007. And since all of us here got out of the third grade, we all had to memorize the names of explorers who were looking for the Northeast Passage, the Northwest Passage. And the fact is that this year, over 60 vessels went across the Arctic Ocean, either along the northern shore of Russia, northern shore of Canada, or directly across the Arctic Ocean, because it's 40% shorter to go from East Asia to Europe via that route. So all of a sudden, we are not only have an economy that's driven by what we have under our feet,
but an economy that may be driven much more based on where we are.
So then the next step that I like to say is we have that behind our economy, we have our resources, and we have our location. But the third thing and the most important thing we have is that resource between our ears, the ingenuity of our people. And the ingenuity of all Americans is really what drives our American economy. I'm going to end by saying this and let John come up here and talk a little bit, and then we'll open up to questions. But here's what's very interesting. I've had a chance as a guy in a garage in Anchorage, Alaska, to help start some companies with global markets. If you use Adobe Photoshop on your computer, and you ever use the digital watermarking provision in Adobe we created that software with a little company called Digimark, which is now listed on the NASDAQ. When we were getting that started, we knew that we were key to helping bring digital television to the world. We were just moving from videotape to DVDs. And the first people to adopt digital television were the dish networks, the satellite networks people. And I remember calling the guy who invented the transducer, a fellow named Taylor Howard, who had worked at Stanford. And he goes, "Where are you from?" And I said, 907 is one of those West Coast area codes, because I was a little embarrassed that, you know, I'm talking to a guy in Silicon Valley from Alaska and that I might have anything at all to tell him. And he said, "No, I know 907. My kid lives in Palmer, Alaska. I'm on to you. Where do you live?" And I said, "Anchorage." And he said, "I'm up there next week. Can we have lunch?" As a result of that lunch, a major strategic deal was made by our company where a $70 million investment went into our company, and we became part of the DVD copyright protection standard. So I'm no longer ever embarrassed about my area code. And the fact is, whether it was that or another company I helped start called Immersive Media that pioneered something called Street View for Google, I know that ingenuity comes wherever you find it, and it's not limited by geography. We have done lots of other things. I've just finished a report in Alaska as co-chair of our State Committee on Research. And the fact is that one of the things this report will do is it will have a section called Inventive Alaskans talking about 20 people who've done amazing things. The Wi-Fi that you may be using right now on your laptop or on your tablet is a suite of technologies, some of whom developed by a friend of mine, Alex Hills, who lives in Palmer, Alaska, and is on the faculty of Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, of all places. But he gets to live where he wants to live. Sunglasses were invented by Alaska Eskimos on a very bright day, about the same time the Chinese figured out how to carve jade very thinly so that the justice could be blind. But the fact is that, and container shipping started there. So we're helping our state understand that innovation is key to our economy as it is key to the U.S. economy. The last thing I'll say, because I've had a string of investments personally in various companies, I sit on the board of a manufacturing company that is based in Baltimore and has factories in Baltimore and Wisconsin that makes dredge equipment. We make the equipment that moves sand, that helps make your port safe and so forth. And the exciting thing about this is we're an American company that exports ships all parts of the world. And here we are competitive in world markets all over the place. Now, what keeps us competitive? John's going to talk a little bit more about this, but I'll just say it starts with the young. It starts with people who understand that making things, mathematics, our emphasis on STEM education is very, very important. It also starts with governments that understand that if you want jobs, foster investment. And that means government shouldn't meddle so much. It means government should be looking at ways to form capital. And there's many things that governments can do there. Most important, get out of the way and not have a tax system that is confiscatory. And then finally, one thing that we can do and we should do is stand up and be proud of what we can do and be supportive of innovation. There's been a lot of innovation here in Utah. We were just visiting with Overstock.com here, a Utah-based company that's doing very exciting things for national markets and more global markets, global sourcing certainly, right here based in Utah.
The fact is, the world we live in today means you can live anywhere, and our strength as a country, in the end, is going to be based on understanding our resources and working very hard to sustainably, environmentally safely develop our resources. It's going to be based on understanding our location, because we have strategic locations in this country, and it's going to be based on the ingenuity of our people. I'm going to turn this over to John, welcome him up, and then let's have a discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. This is the, like this? I just, how about I just swallow it? It'll make it a lot easier.
Oh, is that how you...
All right, so I can walk anywhere then. Hi, I'm John Ratzenberger. Some of you may know me as Hammy the Pig from Toy Story. And where's Buzz Lightyear and Woody? And it's basically the same as Cliff Clavin in Cheers, except that Hammy is pink. Cliff had a uniform, which is in the Smithsonian, by the way. Very proud of that. As Mead had mentioned... I've been an advocate for manufacturing now quite a few years. It's been 15 or 20 years since I did the show called Made in America and traveled around the country. And when I go into these factories, over 300 of them, I realized that the average age at that time was about 45 years old of people who actually knew how to operate machines and make things. And I talked to the CEOs, and they all told me that there's no young people coming into the businesses. And so that's why now the average age is about 58 years old of people who can make things and shape things out of wood, metal, even electricians and carpenters and plumbers, welders. I grew up in a town, Bridgeport, Connecticut, factory town, back east. Anybody from Connecticut? Oh, I know you, yeah. You're from, where were you from?
Stonington.
Oh, Stonington. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, you probably travel through Bridgeport.
Yeah, going to New York.
So. Yeah, you don't want to stop there. No. No. At one time you did, when it was a thriving factory town. Oh, they made everything. As a matter of fact, during World War II, Hitler said in a speech that Bridgeport, Connecticut was the first town he was going to bomb once he could reach it, because he couldn't understand why a town so small made so much. We made tanks and planes and the helicopters and ammunition, sewing machines, the casters that go underneath chairs, chains for motors, even chains for the little light bulb. The Bassick Bead Chain Company, that was my high school, that's where we got our name. So when growing up in that atmosphere, I grew up in a world where everybody had a skill. Nobody did just one thing. Even if you worked, say, the helicopter or the airplane factory, you come home, you still had something else to do. Maybe you were a ham radio operator. Maybe you raised tomatoes in the backyard. Maybe you worked with wood. Maybe you were a cabinet maker. But everybody put their hands to something useful. And so now what's happened, obviously, is that we've been taught that we have to specialize, like do one thing. Well, that's not what brought us to the dance. What I mean by that is our founding fathers, everybody knew how to do more than one thing. And the only reason I go down this road is because I was a carpenter. I graduated from school and got a degree in English literature, and I made a great living as a carpenter before I became an actor. And it was a skill that I still retain, and it's a comfort to know that I can go anywhere in the world and always get a job because I have that skill. I mean, whether it's a carpenter or a hairstylist or a dental hygienist, whatever it is, it's a skill you'll always have with you. So if your big company that you're working for closes down, it's all right. You're still going to get work. Right now, the welder with a certificate will probably start at $75,000 a year. That's after a two-year course in welding, because there's so few of them. I remember, too, going out looking for my first job because my grandfather had been a carpenter, and I thought I was a carpenter because I owned tools. And I walked up to this building site, and this big Italian guy, his name was Ito Teo Parini. He was from northern Italy because he had blonde hair and blue eyes, so he had that Austrian mix in there too. And I said, you need any carpenters? Now here I am, a fresh-faced 17-year-old kid. Oh, you need any carpenters? You know, trying to pretend I'm a guy. And he looked at me, he laughed, he says, so you're a carpenter, huh? So yeah. Yeah, I got a hammer. Hey, it's all right, carpenter. Monday morning, you come. So Monday morning, I showed up, 7 o'clock in the morning, and there's a huge pile of 2x12s. It would fill this room easily. That's how many, because we're building an apartment building. And they were 12 to 20 feet long, each one of them. So I said, all right, sees, you move there. So, eh? So piece by piece, I moved that entire pile. And this was in the New England spring, which is muddy, as we know. You know, those Connecticut guys. You know, and so through the mud, the rain, the snow, every day, 7 o'clock to the time I would drag myself home, I'm picking up these big beams and moving them, you know, across the yard, making another pile. And it always occurred to me, whenever they got new orders of lumber, why they just didn't drop it off there. He had them drop it off there. And I realized after about a month of doing this, that's all I did all day long, that he's trying to see what I was made of. He was trying to see if I showed up on time, whether I was going to start whining, whether I was going to quit the job. And so finally, I got all the big pile over there, and I thought, okay, now he's going to see that I'm worth something and take me on as a carpenter. I said, well, there you go, boss. It's all done. He goes, there's better over there. Move again. So next 3 weeks, you know, because I figured shortcuts. I was getting stronger, too. That was the other thing I loved about the job. It was like, you know, being paid to go to the gym. So did that pile. He says, all right, now I'm going to show you how to hold a hammer. I thought I knew how to hold a hammer, but apparently I didn't. So he gives me the hammer, and he shows me how to hold the hammer. Son of a gun, I didn't know how to hold a hammer. But then he showed me how to drive a nail. And do it so I could just do it in three whacks. Boom, 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 boom. Because I had seen all the carpenters on the site doing that. And I thought, that's really cool. Big, long nail. And then you go, boom, boom, bam, boom, boom. And so because I'm a young kid and I want to be like the guys, a carpenter, I knew that's what I had to strive for. I had to strive for that standard. Now, even though I was inside, none of the carpenters had talked to me. Because, again, I'm a young kid. And they try to do those tricks on me. They say, hey, John, go ask Frankie for a bucket of steam. So at least I was beyond that. I said, yeah, I'll get a bucket of steam. Oh, and the best one is the board stretcher. Hey, John, go to Tony, ask him for the board stretcher. Now, if I had done that, Tony would say, Frankie's got the board stretcher. It says, well, here, no, go down to my house, you know, and tell my wife you want the board. You know, they would have sent me all over town for the board stretcher. No such thing. Luckily, I knew that. So, like I said, none of the carpenters really talked to me. Lunchtime, they'd all gather over there. If I went over, like, hey, how you guys doing? They'd all get up and move over there. Well, okay, I get it. So that went on for 2 or 3 months, and I'm on top of the building now. I got the... You know, standing on the eaves, we're going to put the plywood on the roof of the building, and I'm straddling two, and they're handing the sheets of plywood 8 feet by 4 feet up, and I'm handing them down through the timbers to the guy on the third floor, and he's stacking them because we're going to be using those to do the whole roof. So, windy day, I grab like this, I just try to adjust it so that it doesn't catch the wind face on, because otherwise I'd be like Mary Poppins with a tube belt. So I got it, and all of a sudden I feel something, and Corky and Dana, two French-Canadian carpenters, they're nailing my shoes into the wood that I'm standing on. Now, these are master carpenters, so they're doing it like a machine. Like, now my shoes are nailed into the wood. I'm standing in the wind with a big sheet of plywood, going back and forth. I think if I let go, it's going to go and it's going to kill somebody across the street. And they double and triple knotted my shoelaces, then put carpenter's glue on them. And then they all went off to lunch. So, you don't have time to think because now you have to save your own life. So I got the wood down safely. Luckily, I had the razor Stanley knife and to cut the laces off and got out of my boots. So I spent that whole lunch hour unprying my boots from the wood. But to this day, it's one of the happiest days of my life because that's the day I was accepted. Because I had to prove myself. And that was the day they said, you're okay. And that's the day I became a carpenter. So, to me, in the way I grew up, in the world I grew up in, that was necessary. You just didn't show up to a Little League game and get a uniform and a glove and a bat and a ball and guarantee that you're going to play, and then at the end you get a participation trophy. If we tried out for Little League and we stunk, the coach would look and say, you stink. No, they didn't worry about hurting your self-esteem. Because as far as they were concerned, you didn't have any self-esteem. You're here to play baseball or you're not. So in hindsight, they did you a favor. Because if they say, oh, you stink, go on, get out of here. You had choices. You could practice, become better at the game. You could find another hobby. You could find another sport. But more importantly, it gave you the ability to face an emotional crisis at 8 years old. You didn't have to wait till you were out of college and you were 30 years old. Because we got that chance when we were 8 and 9 years old. We had people telling us we were idiots and we stunk and we couldn't do this and wouldn't be accepted there and got chased out of places. Well, okay, then you figure it out along the way. I always thought we were doing a disservice, you know, to kids today, even to have kindergarten graduations. I just don't get that. I know it has nothing to do with manufacturing. Well, in a way it does. Because you have kindergarten. I mean, what are you giving them a graduation ceremony for? Because they had graham crackers and they napped and didn't poop in their pants? I mean, that's pretty much it. And then, okay, well, here's your diploma and we're going to take pictures with grandma. But what we learned then was we thought we were out playing. Right, we'd be outside, we'd be playing. Well, what was play? We were climbing trees, we were on our bicycles, and there's no cell phones, so you're 8 miles from home, the chain breaks on your bicycle, and again, you're 9, 10 years old, and you know you better be home by the time the streetlights go on, or you're in big trouble. So now you've got to solve a problem. You've got to get this bicycle with the broken chain 8 miles back to the house before the sun goes down. There's nobody to help you. You don't have anybody to call. Even if you had a cell phone, you don't know what your telephone number is. Nobody did. Nobody cared. It's just the way it was. So we had the advantage of being given problems to solve at a very early age. And we grew up like that. But unfortunately, we became the Woodstock generation. You know, I say unfortunately because I was there. I helped build the stage at Woodstock. Because I had the skills, I had the requisite skills. And what's happened since then is we've become, the philosophy now that's trying to govern is this one world, everybody hold hands, and let's sing together, and it's just going to be okay. Well, in reality, it's not. That's why we need to stay a strong nation, and that's why we need manufacturing. When you think about it, every single thing you do, from the time you wake up in the morning to the time you go to bed at night, there's three people to thank. Your mother and your father, for giving birth to you. And someone else that you don't know and you never will, and that's the person who has the ability to put a nut and a bolt together that gives you civilization. That's the reason you can go to a bathroom and have hot or cold water coming out of the taps. Someone had to create those faucets and the pipes that bring the water from the reservoir and the purification systems, the machinery that makes the electricity, the turbines. Someone has to stand at a lathe and fashion metal to 1/20,000th of an inch in order for all this stuff to work, the infrastructure, the civilization. Without it, we're a third world country. And like I said before, when the average age of someone in America that knows how to do things is 58 years old, well, we better start looking at our education system and say, you know, maybe it's a good idea to reinstate shop classes when we were kids, middle school. Again, different time, but we would walk a mile to another school by ourselves, just, you know, pushing each other into the bushes and whatever, but we would take a shop class. And one of the advantages of our shop class is that the teacher had bad breath. So when you were working on something and he'd lean over you to talk, you didn't want him to be anywhere near you, so you made sure you did the job the right first time. Because the last thing you want is him leaning over you going, "You need help here? Hoo-ah!" Your eyes would start watering. So it was all wonderful memories. Now, even people my age, and I go into their offices, and whether they're CEOs or, you know, lieutenant governors of states and very important people, usually around the office there's some item that they made in shop class. And you'll notice that with people around, you know, my age group, that something that they made when they were 12 years old, some little tchotchke that holds pens or pencils, but we had a pride in that, like the roof that I put on the building. I remember when I took my kids back there, this is in Connecticut, where I go back to visit the family because my kids grew up on the West Coast. Every time I drive by that, I made sure from the airport we drive by that building, and I slow down and say, "See that? Your father, it's me, put the roof on that building. I built that building." Just when they were little, and they'd go, "Wow, really, Dad?" And we'd stop, and I'd show them stuff. Then they get older, we come around the corner, "Yeah, Dad, we know. You put the roof on the building." Well, as you know, even though they started making fun of me, they grew up with the appreciation, and I was always building stuff around the house, and you tend to do what you see your parents do. Well, my daughter was the only co-ed in her entire university that had her own toolbox. And everybody was knocking on her door all kinds of hours, days and night to fix things in the whole university, all the other students, because she knew how. It wasn't a mystery to her. And my son now, even though he's degreed and, you know, and he went to good school and this and that, he decided just recently he wants to be a cabinet maker. So we just built a big workshop for him in his garage, and now he's on the road to, because that's what he loves to do. But the important thing is that he's got the skills to do it. You know, it's not the actors that are the essential people of civilization, even though you see TV and you think, you know, someone has crowned the entertainment world as being the royalty of America, or sports stars. We're non-essential. We're really non-essential. The essential people are those people that have the ability to put a nut and a bolt together, to make the nut and the bolt. Because whatever you're studying, it depends, I don't care what it is, it depends first on someone's ability to make something. That's the reason we won World War II. Because we made more stuff faster than the other guy. And the other thing is that if a Jeep broke down, or a tank, or a plane, 10 people hanging around, 9 of them knew how to fix it. And they could probably do it with a piece of wire and chewing gum and a coat hanger. They figured it out. But that's, as Americans, that's who we are. We improvise better than anyone else on earth. That's the way it's always been. So as you go on and taking over, but just keep in mind, whatever it is you do, you know, whether it's an entrepreneur, you have to be an entrepreneur in something. And someone has to make that something. And someone has to build the building that something is housed in. Your car, your bridges. Everybody, it's so non-political, too, because everybody drives over the same bridge. I don't care if you're a Republican, a Democrat, Presbyterian, or pedestrian. Doesn't make any difference. Everybody uses that bridge. Everybody uses the water system, the sewer system, the lighting system. But we need people that know how to make and fix things. So at that, I'll just say good day and thank you. Because if you leave me run on, I will go on for hours on this subject. But thank you for showing up to... Thank you. And are there any questions for the Lieutenant Governor or myself?
Yeah, we have a few minutes left for questions, so if you would like one, please raise your hand. I'll come around with the mic. Please state your full name as well, your first and last name.
This is a little off topic, but it's for the Lieutenant Governor. In reading about Alaska, I've visited your state twice, and it's a phenomenal place. But there was a man named Timothy Treadwell.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you're related and how that impacted your run for Lieutenant Governor to alienate or align yourself with him?
Well, that's a fun question. Timothy Treadwell was a man who was killed by bears after living with bears. He was actually killed out here in the Katmai region, southwest Alaska. I have a son named Timothy Treadwell, and I have a father named Timothy Treadwell. And the day that Tim Treadwell died, the Interior Secretary's office called in Anchorage and got my son, who was eating a bowl of cereal, and said, "You're going to get a lot of calls today because you're the only Treadwell in the phone book." And Tim did get calls, and people asked if he was okay, and he said, "No, I'm not dead. I'm finishing my cereal." Tim Treadwell had appropriated his mother's maiden name, and I don't know the family connection. The other famous Treadwell connection in Alaska is the largest gold mine in the country at the time of the turn of the 20th century was the Treadwell Mine in southeast Alaska on the island which is now known as Douglas Island next to Juneau. So my joke is if I'm running for office down in Juneau, name recognition is hard. Just don't confuse me with the ditch, the hockey rink, or the mine. And in southwestern Alaska, it's don't confuse me with the fellow who's girlfriend died innocently. I'm not sure that Timothy Treadwell was all that innocent because he was doing things that you should not do with bears ever. I'll just leave it at that. Thanks.
My name is Nicole Hedden. I'm just wondering, you made it sound as if the EPA has no reason for stopping the pebble mine. Are there any other reasons that the EPA would stop it that you don't agree with?
Well, yeah, I guess I'll put it this way. We have a process in this country, and in Alaska we have 600 small mines, placer mines that people go out, mom-and-pop mines, and we have right now 6 large operating mines. Now, I've been involved one way or another in permitting some of those mines in Alaska. If you go to northwestern Alaska at Kotzebue, north of Kotzebue, near Kivalina, is the Red Dog Mine, the largest lead-zinc producer in the world. The footprint of the mine is, I believe it's probably about as large or larger than the Pebble Mine would be. If you go to a place like Fort Knox near Fairbanks, there was a large amount of land moved in a valley. The water quality is good. I was involved in permitting that mine. There's a coal mine called the Yusubeli Mine near, also near Fairbanks. There's the Kensington and Greens Creek mines further south. We're working on a mine of strategic minerals. The fact is we need minerals. We use them for our automobiles. We use them for our airplanes and so forth. And we have sets of rules saying, okay, if you're going to dig a hole, A, there's a reclamation process. B, there's a process to contain water so that you're not polluting the water systems. See, there's a process to make sure that you're containing the air or not polluting the air as you're doing it, and there's a process about hazardous waste. Environmental rules in this country basically are in 3 pots. There's a pot of do you or don't you use land, zoning issues locally,
designations of land, and so forth. There are objective criteria that say if you can meet these criteria to not pollute, you can do something. And then third, we've got some results-based laws that say even though you may have A and B, if you're not getting A and B to work right, you have C. There's a provision in the Clean Water Act called total maximum daily loads that may say if you've got 10 factories on a stream and they're all meeting the standard, but the stream is still polluted, you can even ratchet down more the amount of pollution allowed or the amount of effluent allowed. And so we've got those things. EPA came along with this particular mine before they ever presented an engineering plan, before they ever said exactly how deep a hole they would dig, before they ever said what kind of dam would they have to put their mine tailings behind the dam, before they ever said what they would be doing with this. Now, all of those things, if they say it wrong, they won't get a permit. But they at least have the right, having gone through the process of spending over $500 million in making the discovery and proving out the resource, to at least have their day in court. And now here's the EPA possibly coming and pulling the rug out from under them and saying to them, whatever you've spent is worthless, and saying to us who happen to own the land in the state of Alaska, the fact that you own it, we're not going to let you produce it. I don't think that's what that provision in the Clean Water Act is for. Now, there, you know, and in fact, if you read the EPA's own report that they're acting on now, the EPA's own report had dozens of times where they expected that there would be a full-fledged permitting process going forward. So we'll have to wait and see what they do. And there are people who would love to have a simple answer on this, yes or no. And to me, what EPA is doing is equivalent to saying, well, we don't like your family. Some people in your family were bad people. And we're not going to educate you past kindergarten because you just might turn out bad too. And I think what they've got the right to do is to go through the permitting process, and if they meet the standards, they can build a mine, and if they don't, they can't. And I will tell you this. This particular part of Alaska, Bristol Bay here, is the richest red salmon fishery in the world. It is an absolutely magnificent resource. It is a wild salmon resource, and we'd love to have you eat our wild salmon. And I don't want to say that I'm for mining and against salmon. Our official state position is we will not trade one resource for another. But I also believe that we live in a country which has a rule of law, which says we're not going to arbitrarily use vetoes and tell people after they've invested. I'm a lieutenant governor of a state. Well, I have to go out and attract right now the governor, myself, and the people who have some responsibility for this area. We've got to raise about $100 billion to keep that pipeline flowing. We've got to tell people that we're a better place to do business than the Yukon, which is the fastest growing jurisdiction in Canada. That why don't you come to here instead of come to Greenland? And you know what? Our permitting system in this country is so broken that we can't offer that assurance the way those other nations can. And yet, if you go to Norway and sit down with their environmental ministers like I have, they've set standards for offshore drilling that companies know they make it or they don't. The U.S. still hasn't figured out how to do it. So I am all for protecting the environment, and I'll show you an environmental record as long as my arm, you know, of things that I've had a chance to do in my career, from setting up an environmental crimes unit to bringing home administration of the Clean Air Act, to helping bring home administration of the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System. But I can tell you that our system of permitting in this country is broken. And to John's point, I was recently contacted or in contact with a firm that is looking at bringing a product to market. Fascinating new product. Actually, a product that would mean that for the wiring in this building, we would use less copper and it would be more kind of a carbon fiber. Okay? Stronger, lighter, amazing product. And I said, where are you going to build this? We'll help, you know, we've got plenty of carbon source in Alaska. We'd like to be, you know, we'd like to be the site of your factory. And they said, you know what? Because of EPA's permitting requirements, we're going to have to do the first one offshore to prove it works. That's not what we should be doing as a country. We should be protecting the environment and attracting business.
Can I just either add or confuse the issue? That
a while back, I invented a product that replaces styrofoam in packaging. You've probably all seen it. It's in gift baskets. It's a strip of paper that's accordionized. It's sort of bouncy, little shards of paper. You see it all over the place. But anyway, that's me. That's my company. I sold the company, but I just want to give you my environmental street cred. So now the question that I've always asked, now the EPA, it used to be a benign organization, but now it seems like it's being used as a weapon. Case in point, you see the light bulbs here? They mandated that we get these squiggly light bulbs now. Did they ask any of you? Why do they think that we're too stupid to make our own choices in light bulbs? If I want to use a light bulb that uses more electricity, I'm paying the electricity bill. Why do they have to mandate that you no longer will be able to buy an incandescent bulb? And it surprised me that nobody even questioned that. Everybody like sheep just said, oh, okay. All right.
If you like your light bulb, John, you can keep your light bulb.
But also, if you notice, these don't give out really good light. And if you break these, you have to clear the room, especially of children and pets, because of the gases inherent in that light bulb. And there's no place in the United States that makes that light bulb. They're all made in China. But they passed a rule that none of us can buy an incandescent bulb again. It's not the United States. But the other thing that I want to bring up, because you know how they hammer you, small gas station owners, anybody that uses any kind of motor oil, petroleum. But China, over here, there's an air current that comes up, and the ocean current comes over here, and then it comes down the west coast of the United States. 1/3 of California's air pollution comes from China. It's not even counting India, because there is no EPA over there. So when you're buying sneakers made in China, you're contributing to the perception of global warming, water pollution, air pollution, but nobody questions that. And this was an article in the LA Times about 2 years ago. 1/3 of the West Coast air pollution comes from China. So if everyone's so concerned about air pollution, why are we still buying into those products that are creating? And water pollution, there's chemicals, toxic chemicals that pour into the oceans over there from the rivers, from their factories. Nobody says a word. So because you're the future leaders of the world, I wanted to deposit that with you now.
Yeah, my name is John Nilsson, and my question's for John Ratzenberger. My grandpa was a carpenter in L.A. He was an immigrant from Sweden. He knew how to build a lot of cool stuff in Sweden, and he didn't need to have very good English to build movie sets in Los Angeles. And he was able to buy a home that my dad grew up in Los Angeles, right, a mile from the beach, and provide a good lifestyle for his family. I've noticed that you can't do that quite the same way anymore. You couldn't afford to live in that neighborhood where my dad grew up on a carpenter's wages. So there might be some places where you can do that, but he couldn't. So I wanted to say thank you for talking about the dignity of manual labor, especially skilled manual labor and trades, because I think we often try to push everybody into college. And I don't think college is for everybody. I think people that do... that work in those trades need to have a living wage as well. So my question for you is this: what could we do to change that, the valuation? It seems like a lot of people I talk to a little bit younger than me have no interest in working with their hands or doing those kind of things. When I've been in some other countries, some places in Europe, they have certification courses. If you're a waiter, if you're a chimney sweep, you have a higher social standing than a lot of other things that we do here in the U.S., and I was amazed to see that. So I don't know if you have any ideas along those lines.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like, for instance, Germany, I'm betting anyway, they will save Europe because they know what they're doing as far as the trades and the things they build and the products they build. And everything is pristine and done the right way. But that's their system. If you're a plumber, you get the same amount of dignity and respect as a brain surgeon. Because they understand if there's no hot water for the brain surgeon to wash his hands before the surgery, it's because we ran out of plumbers. Well, they understand the connection and the weave. And we used to do that here, but then Hollywood, probably early, mid-60s, started coming out with movies and TV shows that denigrated anyone in the trades. So anybody that walked on the screen with a toolbox, they were either made fun of, or they're below average intelligence, or they're trying to rip you off, or they're not to be trusted, they're the drunk or whatever. So why would a child growing up seeing that depiction want to be that? The only reason I became a carpenter because my grandfather was a carpenter too, and you know, I thought he was a pretty cool guy. And but the important thing too is to let your kids, when you have kids, if you have kids, let them go out and play. Put them in a sandbox. You know, and they learn common sense. The first thing you learn is not to eat sand. <You know? laughs> I just did that for my grandson. Very first thing, he picked it up with. Great. It's common sense at play. So that would be my answer. Reinstating shop classes and saying it. Well, I mean, in the Middle Ages, coming out of the Dark Ages, the rock stars were the thatchers, the people put the thatch on the roof, the carpenters, the glazers, the stonemasons. That's who parents wanted to marry their daughters off to because they're guaranteed they were always going to be working, always going to be putting food on the table.
And John, if I can just add one thing to that. I chair a group of states called the Aerospace States Association. One of the major exports of the United States, one of the things that keeps us strong, that helps balance trade when we buy those sneakers from China, is the export of aircraft. Okay? It's been a challenge for us. Ask the governor of South Carolina the problem that she's had in opening up a new Boeing plant to be hundreds of billions of dollars worth of exports to the United States, where the National Labor Relations Board said, we're not going to allow you, we're going to have a whole long set of hearings before you open a factory in a right-to-work state. It was a huge challenge. And what John's talking about as far as workshops are concerned, or you know, shop is concerned, I'm thankful that I took printing shop. I do have that metal pad that I made in metal shop. I supported my son who's, you know, gone to college, but he went and did the auto shop, and I think that's very important. The other thing is, in our state, we've got a performance scholarship program our governor put through, which is encouraging people to take the higher level math and science. We have more, according to Norm Augustine, who was head of Lockheed Martin, we've got more Chinese Army officers, military officers studying engineering in the United States than we have American military officers studying engineering. And engineering is our future. And so just remember, A, we make things, and teaching ourselves to make things is very important. And I admire, my father was a carpenter as well as a political leader. Both my brothers are carpenters and cabinet makers, and it's a wonderful thing to do. I'm all thumbs. I just was not good at it.
Now, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Please join me in thanking our wonderful guests.